Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hey there, I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love classic Doctor Who and are doing what we can to like the new series too. We're going to take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and what's not so great about our favorite show. And this episode, we have a very special guest, Levi Weinhagen.
Hello.
Hey, Levi.
Oh, thanks for all the cheers, studio audience.
I held mine back. I'm going to see how you do.
Fair
Welcome to the podcast. Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners and say a little bit about yourself?
I make theater. I'm one of the creators of Comedy Suitcase, along with Mr. Joshua Scrimshaw, who you already know.
And wait, who's he? Him! Oh, yeah, okay.
He's one of the top three hosts of the show. I write comedy. I do some arts journalism. I'm a big podcast maker myself. I'm sort of obsessed with the medium.
Could you tell our listeners about some of your podcasts?
Oh, I was trying to keep that secret, but if you want them to know about it. I have a podcast called Pratfalls of Parenting, which is conversations with people who do creative work and also have kids, sort of long-form conversation stuff. I have a science-based podcast called Regret Labs, where we have actual scientists on. It's myself and another comedy performer, Eric McEwen. I make a podcast called What's So Funny About the Making of Comedy. That's for mnartists.org.
He has like 12 more.
Well, let's call it there.
That's
then.
Great. You asked. I can tell you the ideas I have for other podcasts. One where it's three young white guys who love the current Doctor Who series and are making their peace with the old stuff.
No one has ever done that before.
Well, let's move right into round one, Temporal Grace. As fans and Levi, we sometimes get a little curmudgeonly even about this show we love. And that's why we open each podcast with something that makes us just gosh darn happy about Doctor Who. And you know, I'll start, because one of the reasons we have Levi on today is that we're going to be talking a lot about comedy in Doctor Who. And I just finally got around to watching The Enemy of the World, one of the lost Patrick Troughton episodes. I'm a little behind the times. And the very opening scene of that episode has the Second Doctor jumping out of the TARDIS on the beach, and he's basically frolicking down the sand. He strips out of his clothes to his long johns and jumps into the ocean and is kicking his heels together and just being generally a kook. And it reminded me of how much of the comic side, or what we identify as the comic side of the Doctor, originated in Patrick Troughton's performance. I think a lot of us think of Tom Baker as the funny Doctor, but Patrick Troughton is hilarious, and I'm going to be watching a lot more of him.
Kelvin?
Oh, gosh. I was rather intrigued and pleased to see the recent announcement that was all over Facebook and things, where Stephen Moffat basically said, yes, the Doctor can be a woman and probably should be a woman at some point.
Long overdue.
Yeah.
Women.
No.
Are you saying you like the idea that they're open to a woman?
Yeah. Basically, you know, that Neil Gaiman wrote in The Doctor's Wife that, like, the Corsair had been a woman in the past. And I don't recall this because I haven't seen it in a long time, but when the 10th Doctor regenerates into the 11th Doctor, there's actually a moment where the 11th Doctor has to kind of check to see if he's male.
It's been current in fandom since at least when Tom Baker regenerated, because he started making jokes to the press that he could be replaced by a woman, and this was getting a lot of press, and John Nathan Turner was happy to run with it at the time, although I'm sure it wasn't in the 80s seriously considered. But, you know, growing up, we all certainly knew that that was a possibility. It's just who was going to pull the trigger on making it happen eventually.
Still no one.
Yeah. Still no one. It is kicking that.
The answer is no one, never.
We'll keep it positive. But I will just express this concern, is that it's a great idea if they actually have the self-control to not make whoever gets cast as a female doctor, that that is her character.
That she's
is
a woman.
That she has breasts right. And she's a woman. I think they'd have to make so much out of that that it could just be boring.
But that's worst case scenario stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, granted, the writing could be good or bad because Doctor Who's always been...
It's a variable.
Very variable. But yeah, I'm all in favor of a woman doctor. I'd like to see a doctor of color at some point.
Yeah.
I don't care which one comes first. A woman of color would be fine, too.
Ooh, too much. Yeah. Baby steps.
Too far. Baby steps. Right. Let's roll it back to 1970 for John.
You know, just jump head
eventually,
first.
You know, like, sure. We'll get to the 97th doctor, and he'll be like a cloud of nanoparticles with a top hat.
And still a penis.
Yeah.
Yes, but he'll be a male.
It still identifies as male. Yeah. Right.
My main concern would be the combination of how women are sexualized in media and what seems to be a growing willingness to sexualize the doctor, worry a woman would push that further.
I have to think that Moffat would be, or Moffat or whoever the new showrunner would be, at least rather sensitive to that, too. There's a much bigger woman fan base to Doctor Who now than there was when we were growing up.
Yeah.
And
I like watching Joshua try to stay positive.
I'll stay positive. I would much rather see a woman writer or a producer or somebody else.
There hasn't been a woman writer yet.
You know, I think that would be more beneficial, honestly, than a man casting a woman doctor and writing a bunch of boob jokes.
I think that's fair. I mean, I'd like to see
women. I take it back. I want the boob jokes.
You want the boob jokes.
Oh, I'm so conflicted.
Stay positive. We're in a state of temporal grace here, Josh.
All right.
Are we going to table the woman doctor discussion?
We should.
Now?
This should
don't
just
table
be
a woman.
Should we stick a pin in the woman doctor?
No.
For now?
There's Let's no put metaphor. A woman on the back burner.
God.
We can't get out of this.
Oh, this is terrible.
We're in a heterosexist language. We just can't.
When's there going to be a trans doctor? See, he moved us right past it. Pat?
Well, anything is going to be a disappointment after that.
We'll edit it. We'll put you first. We'll put the disappointing
sure
thing first.
You'll fix this in post, won't you, Josh?
Oh, yeah.
Explosion definitely. Sound.
It'll be like, I can't wait till the next man doctor comes along. I love man. It'll be really, really nicely done.
Oh, God.
I'm still in a state of temporal grace.
Yes.
Okay. So in a completely different tack. So for many years, one of the Doctor Who media that I've encountered has been the Doctor Who comic books. We probably all read them in the Marvel editions back in the day. But
yeah,
anyway, so I've been thinking a lot about this thing recently because one of my other interests is war games right now. So I don't know if you guys ever read the series of Doctor Who comics. It's a spinoff. Absalom Dark, Dalek Killer.
I know
you
about Absalom
this
Doc, but I've never
I know
really
of
read
it. Haven't read
He's
it.
Got a chainsaw, and he cuts Daleks in half, and it's awesome, especially when you're 10 years old and you're reading these. Anyway, there's this particular issue where he's getting the team together, and he's meeting a guy who is playing a game, a war game, a chess-like war game of some nature on a planet that's being invaded by killbots. And that are shooting soldiers and things, and the moves that he's playing against his opponent, Clickbrain, the robot, mirror the war that's happening out there. And it's just this wonderful, elegant, six-page black and white story that is surreal and spooky in a weird Doctor Who-y kind of way that I've been thinking about a lot recently for various other reasons. And it's written by Steve Moore, who recently died. I think last year he was a big influence on Alan Moore and the comic book writer Alan Moore, who wrote a whole spoken word thing about his relationship with Steve Moore called Unearthing. So this is one of those forgotten little corners of Doctor Who that hopefully people can check out. And that's my state of temporal grace.
Levi.
I have a lot of things I really like. I mean, one, we mentioned the up and down nature of the scripts. But I think a commitment to an idea is always present. So even if stuff makes no sense at all, they just commit like crazy. Everyone who's in it, everyone who's working on the show just commits. And I feel like that's always been the case.
Yeah, if your mask half falls off, you just keep just going.
To it.
Just keep going.
And it feels like theater to me in that way, and even improv theater to me in that way, where everyone's just agreed, a suspension of disbelief as I play right now. And I just really like that, and that's like at the heart of the whole thing.
In the early years, too, and especially in the William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton era, it was a lot more like filmed theater. They just kept the cameras rolling for the most part, and during the War Games, at one point, I know Wendy Padbury's like pants broke. And so she's like holding them up with her hand behind her hip for an entire episode because they can't stop the camera.
Because they only had so much time in the studio and it would go dark. There was union people working there and they went home at night and it was, you're done.
10 o'clock, they turn out the lights.
And boom, you can't do any more filming. I remember hearing anecdotes where actors would purposely throw swears in because it's the only way they would let them do a retake if they just hated something they did.
I think some of it is even as boiling it down to, like, somebody said, let's put on a show, and everyone just has to say yes to questionable ideas constantly to get something to actually happen on screen. And I like that in this show you can still see that. In a lot of shows, I don't feel that people were like, I'm not sure, let's go for it. I think a lot of really popular shows, in fact, they got sort of boiled down and homogenized because people were worried about whether something would work or not. And I feel like on Doctor Who still, they're like, this might not work, but I'm excited about it, and it's what we started doing, so we might as well just keep going.
It's built into the genesis of the show in that they're like, okay, we have very little time or money. What kind of show should we do? Well, something about a guy who travels through all of space and time.
Because that doesn't
we can pull that off.
Yeah, it still feels scrappy. And as like a, you know, independent theater producer, I feel like it sort of says to you, yeah, you could... You should go ahead and make your idea. No one will notice that you ran out of time and just put up whatever you have.
It couldn't be as bad as the worst of Doctor Who.
That's my new marketing campaign for everything.
And now it's time for round two, Special Topics Dalek. Today, Kelvin will surprise us with an unexpected discussion topic. Kelvin?
I guess I was wondering, guys, when do you think humor works in Doctor Who and when it doesn't work?
I think, to me, the funniest stuff is when it is still in service of the actual narrative or the plot and keeps the melodrama intact. Because as Leeway was saying, with Doctor Who, you have to keep some commitment to the preposterous elements of the story. And if it gets too comic, then it becomes almost just a sketch show. So it's very tricky, and I think often the comic character becomes the Doctor himself and how he deals with situations, but other people in the show need to be taking those situations seriously. Some of the Tom Baker years where every person in the cast is competing to chew more scenery and to take things less seriously, it's
Nyman!
Funny. Exactly. It's funny, and it's fun to watch, but it doesn't feel like anything's at stake.
I think it's narratively valuable for the Doctor to be funny and occasionally a figure of fun to deflate him a little bit, too, because otherwise he runs the risk of being this godlike Time Lord triumphant thing.
Well, I mean, eccentricity has always been one of his hallmarks, and eccentricity is funny. Very frequently has to use humor to keep his opponents off base because he's not, even in the most action man incarnations of the Doctor, like, the third Doctor or whatever, you know, he's still not the most imposing figure.
He's got a slight lisp, which doesn't scare you too much.
Yeah.
I wonder if you guys can think of the times when there's been a cartoonish villain or baddie where it was too silly.
Love and Monsters, really, I think, is one.
Love and Monsters is awful.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one with the 10th Doctor, and it's the guy
who absorbs
people, and he's got him talking out of his butt and armpits.
Yeah,
and he's running around, and he looks like a sumo wrestler, and he's kind of got a diaper on. And I'm making it sound better than it is, actually.
You are.
He's Ian Levine, isn't he? Isn't he supposed to be Ian Levine?
It wasn't scary at all.
No.
I'm trying to think of the stories that are explicitly comedic.
Yeah.
We talked about one a few weeks ago, The Gunfighters.
Yep, and there were a lot in the first Doctor era, because I think they're still experimenting with the format.
Romans is the other one that comes to
Romans,
mind.
Romans, that's just straight farce. Like, Nero is literally chasing Barbara around, like, trying to grab her.
Yeah, and a much better example. It's much more effective than The Gunfighters, too. But
yes, it is. It's actually quite funny. It's cleverly written, but it, again, doesn't even attempt to give you a serious villain in it or a real threat. But that is also part and parcel of the historicals, because there is a certain lack of threat because it's a historical period from Earth. So the viewer already knows what's going to happen. The story becomes merely how do they extricate themselves from history that they know is going to happen and has to happen a certain way.
Well, I wonder if the Tenet stuff especially, there was a lot of him being overtly comedic, and I wonder how that stuff sits with you guys.
Well, I can't even remember what episode it's from when the Doctor suddenly quotes Ghostbusters for some reason. He says something like, who you're going to call, and then the soundtrack kind of quotes Ghostbusters for a second or something.
Yeah.
And I was just like that. That's too... I mean, okay, there's no reason the Doctor would not be aware of the existence of Ghostbusters. he knows a lot of things. There's no canonical reason.
Okay, so
Single greatest sentence you've ever said.
For me personally, the pop culture stuff never sits well. Mm-hmm. If it's strictly a matter of, I've referenced something, and I expect you to find it funny because you know what that reference is, the Ghostbuster reference. Or, well, okay, maybe it's funny, maybe it's not, depending on how effectively it's done. But it doesn't age well, right? You're not going to find it funny the second time. You're not going to find it funny the third time. And you may not find it funny in the first place if it's just referential like that. But if it is character-based humor or even more broad farce like the Romans that's actually funny, then that's when I think it works. I think funny dialogue works. I think the Doctor's eccentricities work.
Well, jumping off of that, I think you're right. You've hit something, because the current pop culture references always feel flat to me. But then when they make a historical reference, that is often a joke, you know, like some sort of as basic as like Bully for You, you know, like some World War II thing. I think those usually play really well. And I think, like you said, Joshua, they're usually in service of still what's happening in the show.
Yeah.
Whereas a pop culture reference is just like Family Guy style. Like, look at a Cosby sweater. You know, like that's, it's not
exactly.
Even, there's no context for that joke.
Yeah, there has to be context or contrast. Is it funny because they're making a historical reference in the wrong time period, so there's some contrast? Is it because they're with Shakespeare and they're making references to Harry Potter? Maybe not my favorite, but at least there's some contrast
there.
It's a
literature. Yeah, there's a connection happening,
Hated that so much.
It might be tenuous, but there's a connection point. I mean, Ghostbusters is just, he just literally says Ghostbusters. And it's an issue with Russell T. Davies, where he was like 20 years out of date with most of his pop culture references. If it were 1988, it would just be killing.
Right. All these mod references.
Well, and satire is another interesting point, too.
That's a whole nother category.
Which I have to think about it in a different way. When I think of the ones that are actively satirical, I think of Happiness Patrol.
The Sunmakers.
Sunmakers, Paradise Towers.
Varos, kind of.
Vengeance on Varos. These aren't funny in a real
sense. Yeah.
But you can tell that they're making active satirical points that made sense at the time. Now they're maybe historical curiosities. Mm. We don't care about Robert Holmes's tax returns today.
Speak for yourself.
But the story still maintains its integrity, first as a story, and then also as, oh, this is interesting that this is a satire from 1979 or 1985 or whatever it was. So those don't offend me in the way that a stray Ghostbusters reference offends
me. Satire, by definition, works on multiple levels. So even if you take the satirical element out, there's usually a narrative construct that can still hold up. You don't need to know that Happiness Patrol has a lot of stuff about Thatcher's England now. It still has a narrative that is cohesive. That satirical element might add to it and make it feel more complete, but there's still a story.
Maybe more recent, but like the Atmos?
The thing in the car.
Yeah. The premise of that whole thing is social commentary, satire. All of the whole structure of that story is hanging on essentially one big joke.
It is a social commentary. It's a good instance of the Russell Davies, let's take something that I find absurd about modern life.
And blow it up.
Yeah. They did it with the Bluetooth stuff, with the Cybermen. Stuff.
And the fat, too. What was the...
Yeah, the Love and Monsters, the absorbable...
The Adipose.
Oh,
the Adipose. I love that little Adipose. I think they're adorable.
They are adorable, but that was like pretty aggressively at modern society.
Yes.
Like,
mm-hmm. Those are all RTD elements, and some of it I think is very effective. Like, I love the Adipose. And some of it, like the Bluetooth stuff, I thought was kind of shallow, but he's certainly attempting something with it. A social satire of the Happiness Patrol or Sunmakers variety. What about those ones, those two Matt Smith episodes? He's the tenant, you know, he's with the guy and his fiance and they're having a baby.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then the next one, he's with the guy and the baby.
That does one of the things that I hate for supposedly kind of dramatic or adventure shows when they decide to do comedy where it doesn't come out of established character traits. For a joke, they change the character. The 11th Doctor's knowledge of humanity goes away for one episode to be really funny. It's the logic where he doesn't understand shaking hands or basic coexisting with a human. He suddenly doesn't understand for comic purposes.
Yeah, that was really boring.
And it could be fun. They don't need to make him a different character to get a joke. Boy, X-Files did it a lot toward the end where suddenly one episode it's dramatic and the next episode they're not even recognizable. They're sketch comedy versions of themselves. And then it goes back to melodrama.
Well, I think you guys are a couple of curmudgeonly old bastards because I liked those episodes. I thought they were funny.
I actually think Gareth Roberts is a really funny writer. But it hits a pet peeve. And because Matt Smith is so funny, and I think there are a lot of funny social situations with the Doctor just having to move in with somebody, they didn't have to make the 11th Doctor as stupid as he was in that.
Oh my God, you guys, I just looked up Gareth Roberts, and I was like, hey, I like that guy. And then I realized he wrote like half of the episodes I hate the most, including my personal least favorite, Planet of the Dead, which I hate more than any other single Doctor Who episode ever.
Maybe you don't know what you like.
I don't. I'm confused, Levi.
It's such a cliche, but, you know, a broken clock is correct twice a day.
Yeah.
Thanks, Grandpa Kelvin.
I've been telling you.
Next time someone says such a cliche, you have to pause so we can all guess which cliche you're going
to
say.
I'm about to spout some old-timey wisdom for you.
Do that for your hip voice from now on.
It's like I'm telling you, young fellers. Don't count your tortoises before they're hatched.
Yeah. I'm done. I'm beyond done. Yeah.
So, do you guys see the Doctor as an essentially comic character?
Yeah, I think it is central to the character, but it can be expressed in different ways. You can have a pompous Doctor who's funny because of that. You can have a goofy Doctor. You can have a clueless Doctor, and it's all been done. But I think there has to be something funny about the character of him. Otherwise, he runs the risk of being too distant of a figure and too overwhelmingly controlling of a figure.
I wonder, though, does he have to be funny or does he have to have a sense of humor? Because I think those are slightly different angles.
Not quite the same thing.
And they've done both of those.
I want the Doctor to always get jokes, but I don't think every Doctor should have to tell jokes.
And it moves. You can look at it from William Hartnell, who's pretty straight with a couple little quirky moments, kind of grandfatherly bits of silliness, and then we get
I got your nose.
Like that.
That's a missing episode. I've never seen that one.
Doctor Who and the I Got Your Nose.
Where's that nose?
They're trapped in the Hundred Years' War, and he gets out of it by grabbing Joan of Arc's nose.
Kelvin's just writing this story right now. Just...
What were you saying, Joshua?
It seems to react from regeneration to regeneration. Then we've got the very clownish, absurd acting second Doctor. The third Doctor gets very serious. And you see an interesting change where the comedy comes from his extended unit family. They're the comic figures. And often the third Doctor is the straight man in that situation. And the fourth Doctor, obviously, is Tom Baker through and through and is just funny at all times. And then again, they rein in Peter Davison.
He's not a very funny Doctor.
No, his Doctor isn't. I think as a performer, Peter Davison is very funny and very understated. Yeah, so it just kind of keeps going back and forth. And then the sixth Doctor gets too violent and serious, and so they bring in Sylvester McCoy and make him act in his first season just beyond goofy, playing spoons and falling down. But that was not in a good way, because I'm a big fan of falling down, but artless falling down, damn it.
They
managed to then pull him together, too, by his last two seasons, where they integrate that sort of clown persona with more of a aged, tired being. And though they're pretty much silly all the way straight through with the new series, other than, I guess, Eccleston.
Eccleston wasn't.
Well, he was still kind of goofy, kind of bobbing his head to Tainted Love.
He was
That's just ill-advised. That's not funny.
I would call him awkward, not funny.
But he's at play a lot of the
time. Yeah,
yes.
Which is not the same thing. I wonder if you guys think of the show, in broad strokes, as comedic. because to me, there's the show deals with this cosmic joke idea. Look, we're all going to die, and everything's sort of meaningless. You have to sort of imbue things with meaning. And to me, that every component of Doctor Who is like a one big joke.
So now we move into existentialism in Doctor Who. Great.
Oh, we move into it? It's not
already there?
It sounds
like a second special topics, Dalek.
Yeah, I don't think it's at heart a funny show.
It's definitely not a tragic show if you're using the classical division.
The two masks.
Yeah. I see where you're coming from. There's so much darkness within it that it does seem like the show is essentially comic because it acknowledges that and then moves beyond it and tries to overcome it.
Maybe even in the sort of academic sense of comedy, where
the academic, not funny sense,
right,
of comedy.
Greek, the Greek take. Right, I wouldn't argue it's a laugh-out-loud, funny-always series. It's at play with the idea of life, which to me is just a joke idea.
I've got a whole thing. But it's going to be a whole thing if I say it. So,
just say it.
So the two poles of my adolescent existence were Doctor Who.
I just heard poles and adolescent.
Poles. I had two of them. They were long bamboo poles.
I thought your parents were Polish.
They were hard to get in and out of my apartment with my mom.
This seems way off topic.
Start over.
So on one end, I had Doctor Who, and on the other end, I had H.P. Lovecraft. And these were both things that I was and am still into. But their ideas of the universe are completely apart. They are poles apart. The Lovecraftian view of the universe is that we are all specks of dust, and everything is completely meaningless, and there is no order in the universe, and all we can expect is to be ignored by cosmic gods until they step on us, essentially. But Doctor Who has a much sunnier view of what the universe is. It's violent and cruel sometimes, but there are people out there like the Doctor who are going to intervene, and they can save you and they can make you all right. It's essentially an optimistic view of human nature, and it talks about values such as friendship and honor and not being cowardly or cruel and things like that, and helping people out in need, and it has an expansive view of where humans are going to exist in the universe. And it's the complete opposite of the nihilistic universe of Lovecraft. So, for me, yes, I do view Doctor Who as essentially comic in that way, because it's overcoming tragedy and actively using human potential to go beyond that, even though the Doctor isn't human, I know that. But anyway, that's what I have with that. Sorry.
And now, round three, the randomizer. Okay, now normally this round we discuss a classic adventure chosen at random, hence the name, but for today's comedy-themed episode, we've disabled the randomizer so we can talk about a specific episode, City of Death.
Well, like they say, the randomizer's a useful device, but it lacks true discrimination.
It does lack true discrimination.
Geek.
That's why we chose this episode for our comedy special.
Because even though the credits say this is written by David Agnew, it is mainly written by Douglas Adams, I think with contributions from David Fisher and Graham Williams.
Wikipedia tells me Fisher wrote the original script, but then couldn't script edit it.
Because he was divorcing.
Yeah, so there was a huge rewrite on it by Douglas Adams.
Then they were going to set it in Paris, and then someone had the idea, you know, if we actually go to Paris, that'll actually be cheaper than trying to recreate Paris on a bunch
of
sets.
That's John Nathan Turner. He knew how to do those things.
And so thus it became the first ever story filmed overseas.
Tell it's the first one because they just loved to show the shots of them just
running
around Paris.
some long in front of famous landmark shots with music to just cover that nothing's happening.
If you take that out, it's honestly a three-part episode.
Uh-huh.
It's a fantastic three-part episode. And personally, I can watch the Doctor and Romana run around Paris I find it highly entertaining.
I
know.
When I first saw this as a kid, I was kind of frustrated. Do something.
Run
now,
faster.
Now when I watch it, I really love it because it just makes it seem more relatable. You know, the Doctor and Amon on a train just kind of looking out, oh, look over there.
It bore
just
the pants off Levi.
It didn't bore the pants off me, but
he's wearing pants, everybody.
Rewatch, I mean, don't I haven't worry. Seen any of these since I was very young, and watching it now, I was just thought that was a waste of money because Paris didn't add anything. Like, the stuff in, like, the museum was all soundstage. Yep. It was so superfluous. And why, yeah. Did they go to 14 cafes in one day?
Well, if I went to Paris, I would go to 14 cafes in one day.
That's what I did.
Yeah. Well, I do love the opening shot of this. I like model work. I'm always a sucker for model work.
The Jagaroth ship.
Yep.
I really
and it looks really pretty. The camera work is really nice. And then it pans in and you see the mask and you go, that's where they saved the money.
Mm-hmm. I like the mask though. It's cool. I mean, it can't move or like, it doesn't move. Really fit the body.
No.
Well, that's Doctor Who for you, right? That's
part of the charm.
That is absolutely part of the charm. It's part of the old series. You won't hear me say much bad about City of Death. It might be overlong. It might not have needed to have been filmed in Paris. And, of course, the mask is super silly. But I love this. I watched it again yesterday for this podcast. And I was just noting down all of the wonderful Douglas Adams lines.
The lines are very Marx Brothers-esque. They're lines that just seem straight out of Groucho's mouth.
This, I actually wrote that exact same thing on my notes.
There are a couple lines specifically like, have you heard of Scarlione's angle? No, I was never any good at geometry. I mean, they're just like,
who sent you? Who sent me what?
Well, okay. No, I wrote in this, Baker is all three Marx Brothers. He's doing all of them.
Yeah.
And then he's in the Pink Panther. So he's like, he's Groucho, Chico, and Harpo.
And Inspector
in
Rousseau.
The Pink Panther.
And Catherine Schell, who plays Lady Scarlione, was in The Return of the Pink Panther. Mm-hmm.
I'd also like
so
to
there you go!
I'd also like to mention, I just saw Catherine Schell in a minor Hammer horror film called Moon 02.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the same year as she was in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Ooh.
As a very minor Bond girl.
This is a really an amazing cast.
Yeah.
Julian Glover.
In this story.
I love Julian Glover.
Julian Glover, again, speaking of Bond, he has this very sci-fi Bond villain quality.
What's the name of the scientist in this episode?
Kerensky.
Did anyone else, maybe it's because I watch Portlandia, but he looked like a Fred Armisen character.
He does look like Fred Armisen.
The whole time I could, like...
I didn't think of that, but...
That all seemed like jokes to me. I love the, what a wonderful butler, he's so violent.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
That is very
It's a great line, and Tom Baker delivers it so well, because he takes the fall and then pops up from behind the chair, and he's like, that was great. Push me again.
There's a part where he falls in the museum, and his scarf gets actually tangled on something, and he just, like, fell into it. Like, that's what I'm talking about that, like, he's just committing to this,
oh, yeah.
Like,
and he does a lot of physical comedy in that scene. He does the spin around when the tour guide tries to talk to him, and he misses her, and then he does... We know narratively the reason he bumps into everybody later is because he's picking pockets and putting the bracelet in Romana's pocket and taking it from the Countess. But in that moment, it's just this absurd long feint where he bounces into, like, three different people and then collapses in her lap.
I have to do one more, which is, you're a beautiful woman, probably.
It's one of my favorite lines from Doctor Who, and it does sound like it could have been straight from Groucho.
Yeah, that's
mouth.
Groucho.
Yeah.
I swear Groucho wrote that line. I want to say it all the time after rewatching this. Like, I'm going to probably get
careful
my wife
where
so
you
mad.
Use it, yeah.
There's a part where the Count walks in and asks, can you throw a little light on it? And then it's a literal punchline. He throws a light at him and punches him. Yeah, like, he actually is a punching during a punchline, which to me also seems like totally a like a Marx Brothers sort of anarchy moment.
It's interesting because that whole punching thing with Duggan seems like a joke, but it's a nice thing where narratively it comes to the end, where usually that would be really anticlimactic and maybe typical of a Doctor Who, where it's all this four-part or six-part or eight-part buildup and it ends because someone pushes a button or punches a guy. But here, the anticlimactic moment where they get to the beginning of creation and this dopey detective just socks the alien, it's very satisfying because it's the completion of a joke.
And yet, despite being this very punch-oriented guy, Duggan, to me, never really comes off like a dope.
I think what's going on there is that the actor is a little bit too good for how he's been scripted, because he's very likable, and he's got great comedic delivery, and he says lines like, what am I going to see today? Half a dozen Eiffel Towers lying about after he sees all the Mona Lisas. But he's scripted as, and the internet had to remind me of this, as a parody of Bulldog Drummond, the...
Yeah, he's got the trench coat.
The trench coat, and I read one Bulldog Drummond novel way back in the day and was never tempted to read anymore because they're extremely xenophobic and racist, and the character
What's the name of that? I gotta just...
Bulldog Drummond.
Those online. Okay, cool.
Just go to xenophobicracist.com.
Well, I mean, repetitive and racist? You know,
the early phases of this script, it was going to be kind of a parody of Bulldog Drummond.
Yeah. And that lingers into how they react to the character.
Yeah.
But the character himself is much more likable. And you'd like to see him as a companion, right?
Yeah.
Interacts with him the way he acts with Harry Sullivan in the early Tom Baker days. You'd love to see Duggan travel in the TARDIS. And he's great.
He pulls off a couple great idiot moments. I love his slow realization at the very end when they've gone to the beginning of time. They've traveled back in time. And the Dr. Romana are talking and he suddenly... It's a spaceship. It dawns on him suddenly. The whole plot comes together.
Well, even after that, when they come back, he still sort of goes like, I'm not sure about you two, if you might be different than everyone.
He's a great foil because everyone else is so incredibly urbane in this episode. Mm-hmm. You have Count and Mrs. Scarleone just, you know, lounging around in their beautiful, beautiful costumes. And the Doctor and Romana know everything, and then Duggan's just this what? Somebody hired me to do something.
Although I love how nonchalant the French people in the cafe are when people are drawing guns on each other over and over again, and they're just like...
I think part of, like...
Another day in the left bank.
You know, that makes this sort of weirdly effective is that they were filming in Paris. No one in France had any idea what the hell Doctor Who was at the time. So, you know, you just kind of see the everyday Parisians on the street and they just kind of look at him like, who's the weird tall guy with the scarf?
We're talking a lot about the comedy of it, but what I think helps out a lot, too, is that there's a great kind of puzzle part of the story and the actual plot is pretty cool. I realized watching this, Stephen Moffat is the poor man's Douglas Adams with Delusions of Grandeur. You know, it very much reminds me...
You should be happy
early,
with that as well.
Yes. Early timey-wimey stuff and moving backwards and forwards through time within the same episode. It has a lot of stuff that is now just an every episode type of thing in the new series.
It's full of just wonderful little joyful plot revelations. Yeah. Why are there all these Mona Lisas behind the thing? Oh, it's because he painted seven of them.
Best cliffhangers.
When you see Julian Glover in the 16th century.
When you see Julian Glover in Leonardo's apartment. And I think the end of the first one is really good. You know, even though it's a very terrible mask and everything, but like when he takes the mask off and you realize it's this alien thing.
Although there's no real narrative reason other than the cliffhanger for him to do it.
But
he's going to shave or something. I don't know, because he just kind of walks up to the mirror. I think it's time to look at my alien face.
You know, but...
You don't have those moments. You know,
when I first saw this as a kid, I was just like, what in the hell?
No, it hooks you, and that's the thing. The comedy doesn't undermine the narrative. You're engaged because it's funny, but you're also engaged to find out what happens next. I mean, we were talking earlier how if it's too comic, there's nothing to really commit to. And the puzzle part of the story of why are there multiple versions of the Count, what's he doing with all these Mona Lisas, helps keep you moving along. It keeps the narrative and momentum with the jokes.
And the breaking of a Ming vase, like that everything was priceless in the house, was really funny, but it also, it all added to the sort of solving of the mystery of what's happening. Like, that was that thing of like...
That's why he has all the super valuable stuff. He's just been collecting it.
Right.
But you're right. Seemingly throwaway jokes support the overall story.
Yeah, the whole time. Pat, you kind of hit on that. There's all these actors who are working above their station. So the Leonardo da Vinci guard guy should not have been such an endearing character. He has like two lines and a grunt, and he gets goofily knocked out because of a Polaroid photo. But I somehow cared about that character really quickly, and I think it's because that performer just had a depth.
It's a really good tiny part.
Well, the guard, of course, does get the one great line, when you work for the Borgias, you'll believe anything. So that endears you to him right away.
And Baker, like, he told the audience, that's a good line. Like, there was that tiny little head movement of like, huh? Mm. Pretty good writing, huh?
That's right. I acknowledge that, yeah. Oh, God, you guys, I mean, I could nerd out about this adventure for another hour. I love everything about it. I like the spidery Jiggeroth ship. Yeah. I love Julian Glover and Catherine Schell's wonderful clothes, the white suit with the teal cravat, or her sleeveless black blouse and slacks with the chunky necklace and stuff. Just everything about it is gorgeous. It looks great. I think
he loves fashion.
And just for,
I love Leonardo's mirror writing. He puts the mirror.
That was a cool touch.
That is a nice reference.
And
there.
As comic as this episode is, and as much loved as it is for its comedy, it's still a pretty scary plot. I mean,
the fate of the human race is
Scaroth
at stake.
Is a hell of a villain. I mean,
he has scare in his name.
He has scare in his name, and he, you know, I mean, he's trying to keep life from even evolving on the Earth. That's kind of extreme.
What a dick.
But at the end, we just go back to the beginning of the episode and nothing happened.
Yeah.
Right.
When I saw John Cleese in a Doctor Who episode as a kid, I mean, you could not have made my head explode more. It was
and
like
that woman,
the intersection of two of my favorite
Eleanor
things.
Eleanor Braun.
She's in...
everything. Help. Joanna Lumley's mom in Absolutely Fabulous.
Comedy Lineage.
Yeah, she's around. Like, well, you guys, I think we got to wrap it up on City of Death, although we could sit here all night, like
oh,
I said.
Oh, man, it's such a good episode.
Everything is so good.
Looking back, apparently when it was first broadcast, it was not very well liked.
It had really high ratings because there was an ITV strike.
There was
so there was nothing else to watch.
But the critics and the fans were not terribly fond of this story when it came out. Its reputation grew over the years.
And now it's often cited as one of the episodes to show to people to get them introduced to the new series. Hmm. I have
mixed feelings
about that. Yeah,
it's not representative enough.
So it's a good way to trick people into watching something that will ultimately disappoint them.
Exactly.
So for this installment of Wonderful Afunctionalism, unfortunately, Kelvin can't join us. But we do have a special guest on our program, the Ice Warrior, Sizzix. Hello, Sizzix. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here.
I hope you're not finding this weather too unseasonably warm for you.
It's okay. I'm wearing a thong. Thongs are not as visible on the Martian race as they are on humans. I thought I could pull it off. Officially, we go Commando. Is this not normally discussed among humans? I know so little of your race.
Changing subjects for a moment. You have a long-standing relationship with the Doctor Who program.
Yes.
You've appeared with several of the Doctors.
Yes.
Could you say who was your favorite Doctor to work with?
Tuffy. It was probably the second. He had the best fitting pants.
So we're talking about comedy in Doctor Who today, and can you tell us a little bit about comedy on Mars?
Well, the timing on Mars is somewhat different than the timing of human comedy.
Faster paced?
Actually, yes.
Is there a place for physical comedy on Mars, or does that not play there?
There's so much ice on Mars that, of course, physical comedy is inevitable.
Is there any Earth influence in Martian comedy? I know you receive our signals.
We tend to prefer Shemp to Curly, which I understand is the opposite of most humans. None of that Curly Joe crap, though.
Are there any famous Martian comedians?
No! Women have no place in our society. Do you know how hard it is to cut an ice warrior suit for the female form?
No, how hard is it?
It's a hard carapace. And women have all those curves. I mean, think about it.
Well, you'll excuse me for saying so, Sizzix, but those sound like...
We're sexist bastards!
You got there first.
So I would take it that you would not be comfortable with talk of a female doctor. Or would you be comfortable
what
fighting a woman?
What in the holy hell are you talking about? The doctor as a woman? I'm going to blog about this. This is entirely counter to the basic point of the show.
Well, do you think maybe some of these outmoded ideas of yours might be why Ice Warriors have sort of dropped down a couple skills? They used to be a good B-level
what
villain
are you
in Doctor
implying?
Who.
Implying?
I'm just saying, used to be right below the Daleks and the Cybermen, and they brought the Macra back before the Ice Warriors. Do you think maybe if you updated your sensibilities a little, you might get some more screen time?
You're asking me to compromise. We are Ice Warriors. Not ice conciliators.
It does seem, though, that this focus on the green male power structure could be the cause of your ultimate downfall.
It's been discussed. Usually, we just have another beer and watch the game.
So my final question, Sizzix, is referring to the Matt Smith episode Cold War, taking place on the submarine. We see for the first time an Ice Warrior remove his armor
yes.
and slither, if you'll forgive the term, around
no, that's fine.
The submarine.
Ultimate Commando.
Yes!
Could you explain why this hadn't been presented on the show before?
We are a modest race. I know that sounds strange. Coming from an extraterrestrial in a thong.
Well, I hope they gave you a little bit of extra money for that nude scene.
Yes, it's similar to how humans are paid more if they're willing to drop trowel.
Will we be seeing more of you? Let me rephrase that, Sizzix. Will you be appearing on Doctor Who again in the future?
Yes, we've got a real whiz bang cooked up with the Dominators.
You heard it here first, folks. The Dominators teaming up with the Ice Warriors. Thank you, Sizzix.
You're welcome. Is the restroom over here?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
And now for our fifth and final round, the Death Zone. In this round, we pair two or more Doctor Who texts or characters from any medium or period in the show's history, and see how they stack up against each other.
This is our comedy episode. We're going to be pairing Curse of the Fatal Death and the Five-ish Doctors. So what do we think, guys?
Do we vote right away, or do we save it?
You mean like better? Vote better? Or
yeah,
funnier?
Which one? Two episodes enter, one episode leaves.
As the superior piece of Doctor Who
it's the
parody.
Death Zone.
It's not as simple as that, though.
Okay, we're going to talk through it then.
All right.
I feel like there's still some ambivalent feelings, and we need to work out.
We're going to come to an answer by the end of this segment.
Levi is super
And we've got four people, so we have the excellent chance of a tie.
They are two very different styles of
yeah,
comedy.
They are.
One's a more heartwarming, affectionate thing, and the other one's just straight up.
Funny.
Well, I would say The Five-ish Doctors is very much that office style of kind of embarrassing documentary kind mm-hmm. of style humor, whereas Curse of the Fatal Death is kind of, it's like the Are You Being Served of Doctor Who parodies.
I also think, though, one is for deep cut Doctor Who nerds, and one is for a much broader, you don't even really, I mean, you barely have to know the series.
Yeah,
that's absolutely right, and it's totally a function of when they were made, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because back when Curse of Fatal Death was made, it was made for a broad audience who kind of remembered Doctor Who, and they would know the Master,
yeah,
they would know Regeneration.
And it was written by Stephen Moffat, and essentially all the jokes rely on nothing having to do with Doctor Who, really. It's a lot of poop and fart.
It's
and
a lot
jokes.
Of poop jokes.
Miles of poop jokes.
Just literally.
Seeing outtakes of Jonathan Pryce checking his lines as the Master and like going, I can't believe I'm saying this. Like walking through 900 miles of feces or whatever the
Because that's...
Yeah, he falls into it three times. And
because
has
that's
to
9 times funnier than 100 miles of feet. It's just basic math. Yeah.
And science.
Yeah.
It's a variation on the rake joke from The Simpsons, where Sideshow Bob just keeps stepping on the rake until it gets funny again. But I don't know. It's kind of funny, I guess.
Yeah, I never found Curse of the Fatal Death that funny. I think it comes to life in the regeneration sequence.
And the regeneration sequence is the only part that plays a little bit more on the show.
Yeah, there's a couple other kind of broad Doctor Who-related gags. You're the camp one, or why are there chairs on a Dalek spaceship? All these corridors look the same. But yeah, using the cameos for the Doctor to regenerate into is much more lively.
And they don't work off each other. They seem really disconnected. The Doctor Who references themselves are there, and then the fart and poop jokes are there in case nobody gets the Doctor Who jokes. There's not a contrast. Like, they don't make
each other funnier.
And there's also,
like sex jokes, like the Doctor's gonna marry his companion or some goddamn.
Yeah,
you know,
Joanna
like
Lumley
that.
Plays with her boobs. Yeah. There's talk of the
I
master.
I like that part.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
No one can complain about that.
I can't complain about
the master has his Dalek bumps. And then at the end, the Doctor and the Master go off together.
Right.
In a sort of homo / heterosexual shipping that would only work in Doctor Who and nothing else.
It's weird how much in this actually comes to pass in Stephen Moffat's actual tenure on Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Marriage, gender swapping regenerations. Oh, and the timey-wimey thing. The whole, like,
I went back a few minutes
back
earlier.
In time
yeah.
a few minutes earlier. It just reads as a goofier version of a Stephen Moffat script today.
There's much more time spent writing the 5-ish. But for me, not having as much of a deep knowledge of earlier Doctors, so much stuff fell flat. And it felt like a mix of rewarding current fans and rewarding old fans, which is, I think, what it wants to do. But then if you were like a new fan who like got into the modern series, then you'd be like, oh, I know I'm missing stuff. Like, crazy.
You're totally right. It's for old school nerds who recognize all of those swirling faces around Stephen Moffat when he's having the nightmare.
Yeah.
And laugh when Matthew Waterhouse comes on.
It bounces back and forth, though, between the investment in old Who
it
and investment
in
new, because a lot of it rides on your knowledge of where new and old Who overlaps, whether it be explicitly or awkwardly, or in the fact that Peter Davison's daughter is having the children of David Tennant, the 10th Doctor, and there's a lot going on there, and John Barrowman jokes.
I like the Barrowman stuff.
Yeah, that I thought that was gold, hiding his secret nuclear family.
That was really funny.
Yeah, God, I haven't seen it in a while, and I'm like having a hard time remembering.
That's great for a podcast.
Mostly, yeah, I know.
It's
I
mostly poop jokes.
I planned ahead.
Let's quiz you on what you do remember. So what sticks out about the 5-ish Doctors reboot to you, Kelvin?
I think just a certain sense of affection for seeing Peter Davison and Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy together as sort of a
Scooby team.
Sort of a Scooby team, and when they get their Doctor outfits on, and then they go into like the current TARDIS and they're just confused, like, what is this?
I saw that coming and I still liked that.
And the little cameo of Paul McGann, who just sits there and goes, nope, and then just like gets up.
Well, that he's the guy who's on the cusp of the old and new series and he still gets work, so he's kind of on the inside and the outside.
Yeah.
I mean, I was kind of blown away by the Peter Jackson cameos and Ian McKellen and that they
an
managed to
piece.
Swing that, and I think that was hilarious. I like that they are willing to make fun of themselves and make fun of the show, and that they can get there are other people like Peter Jackson who still loves the show, or Ian McKellen who is friends with Sylvester McCoy and are willing to do those things.
Well, and the joke, I honestly think it'd be better without. This is a great joke. I do wonder your opinions. To me, I thought it was a little long. I think half an hour. I mean, I know it was built for a specific showing, but some of that might just be a product of me knowing I was missing half the jokes.
It's probably a little long at 30 minutes, but then I thought Curse of Fatal Death was probably too long at
that was
whatever
long.
It was.
Because we get it.
Yeah, we get it. For this, there is so much. It's like an unending series of Easter eggs for old fans. So the only time I thought it really flagged for me personally was when they're running around after they had already been in the Dalek suits.
Yep, I think that's where the only flag. But it makes it pretty far in before it starts to feel a little, okay, we could wrap it up.
They could have just cut to the bus.
Sure, but you're right. It comes down to, is it your brand of too long? I mean, because everything is aimed just right at you as a geek. Yeah, and if you don't get the old series references, because Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy are actually quoting and misquoting lines from actual TV episodes that you have to have lived a long, sexless life to remember.
And I've been short and sex-filled.
Ultimately, I appreciate the deadpan style of humor in the Five-ish Doctors. I like the dryness of it. It seems smarter to me.
It was smarter.
But not afraid of making crude jokes either, and jokes at the expense of people. I mean, I love Peter Davison, and that even his grandkids aren't even interested in the Doctor.
I wound up seeing Curse of the Fatal Death like two or three times, like within the same weekend with groups of people, because I think it was at, wasn't Convergence, but it was like a...
He's like 56 years old now. I'm sure it was at Convergence, or was it at a different
convention?
It was
sometime back in the Ford administration. I don't remember where. But it was like one of these geek social events that was at the hotel.
Gonna have to be more specific.
The Radisson / Sheraton / Doubletree, because it's changed ownership so many times. But it was like...
We'll footnote that for our listeners.
Yeah.
I want to see how far away from his point he can get.
Do you remember if you had a sandwich?
I must have had a sandwich. I was probably hungry. But, you know, I saw it with a group of geeky people, and they were all way into it, and so there was that group camaraderie watching Curse of the Fatal Death, whereas I watched the Five-ish Doctors just by myself at home on the computer screen, and it's just, it's a different experience.
With the lights off, and no sandwich.
But that's funny you get at something, because I think poop jokes are better enjoyed in a group of people.
Yes.
Yes.
And nerdy references to your childhood love are better alone in the dark.
Yes.
I think that you saw both of them in the exact right
ideal
context.
Ideal place.
Well, no, I get what you're saying here, because when Curse of Fatal Death came out, there was no televised Doctor Who, so that's...
It was fresh and cool.
There were people who tried to actually argue that Rowan Atkinson was the legitimate Ninth Doctor and that this was canonical. I mean, there were people who were that desperate to see anything that looked or resembled Doctor Who.
Just now I'm just thinking about how we talked about comic actors have been really good doctors, but Rowan Atkinson would be a terrible doctor.
He played it very straight. Which obviously had to be a very conscious choice
right.
to be that dry.
But it felt exhausting for him to play it.
Can I do some weird facial expression right now?
He got a little when he was farting. When he was speaking in farts, he got to make his funny faces.
It's true. Yeah, I think I go five-ish.
Yeah, for me, obviously, five-ish Doctors, too. If for no other reason than it made me love Russell T. Davies parodying himself as a sad version of himself. Even Peter Davison won't take his calls. Yeah, for me, there's no question. I like Curse of Fatal Death. I do laugh even at the poop stuff, but Five-ish Doctors by far.
Yeah, I remember laughing harder at Curse of Fatal Death, but yeah, I mean Five-ish Doctors is just more heartwarming and on some level. And
that's tough to hear. As a comedian, you don't want to hear someone go, I remember laughing harder at other stuff, but yours is good.
It is not what you want. And I love fart jokes and poop jokes still.
But no, I laughed until I cried at the Five-ish Doctors. I loved all the just awkward humor. I guess it had a heartwarming quality to it. It was affectionate, and I think that's Peter Davison's strength. He's like that in the audio commentaries on the DVDs, where he can make terrible fun of the episode as he's watching it, but it has an affectionate quality. And some people just have that and can be mean and still likable at the same time, and he has that.
Well, it's like how you can make fun of your family, but no one else should make fun of your family. That's what Five-ish was really doing, was like, we're part of this club, so we can make fun of it. And that wasn't in Curse, even though there was funny. Yeah.
If there was just one moment where Colin Baker just let rip.
He just wanted one fart joke?
And then it would
have been the Five-ish Doctors.
Kelvin, I promise you that if we ever meet Colin Baker, I will ask him to fart for you.
Oh, God.
You're a good friend.
So Five-ish Doctors.
Five-ish doctors.
In the death zone. Yep.
Yes. What's the word I'm looking for?
Unanimous.
Unanimous. Unilab. Thank you.
Unicorn. Unicycle. And that's our show. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please tell all your geeky friends, or better yet, write a review on our iTunes page. We would like to thank Levi for joining us for our all-comedy episode. Thank you, Levi.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You contributed some material. Good. Excellent work.
Kind of care.
We'd also join us next episode when we will be... What will we be doing?
So for next episode, the randomizer tells us that we're going to discuss... Number 102, The Power of Kroll.
Oh! Yeah!
Wow.
Oh, all right. Wonderful.
Just racking up the classics. Join us next episode when we will be discussing The Power of Kroll.
Kroll! Kroll!
Kroll!
And in the Death Zone, we will be pitting the new series episode, Dalek, against the Big Finish Audio Jubilee.
Oh, wow.
Jubilee!
Jubilee! Dalek!
There's no Jubilee chant, Pat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Until then, this is
Pat,
Kelvin,
Levi,
and Joshua saying,
get off my world!
I mean, if I was, you know, drinking beer and eating a sandwich.
Wait, you waited that long to just say beer?
I was trying to think of a particularly geeky form of alcohol, and nothing came to mind. Because the first geeky form of alcohol that came to my mind would have been in like 14-year-old scotch, but that's actually cool. And I didn't want to put a cool booze there. I wanted something more stupid.
Don't worry. We'll fix it in
I
post.
I am way overthinking
all this. All this is staying in.
Take us through the process.